Okay.
This is Mame Warren. Today is the 23rd of December, 1999. Last interview of the year with Bill Lachlan, and we're in Herndon, Virginia, of all places. All right, let's start at the beginning. Why Johns Hopkins? What brought you there in the first place?
Okay. In 1938, when I graduated from high school, Irene Davis Corwin was the registrar. And the registrar was the director of admissions, the registrar, the director of financial aid, the house mother, ran the dormitory, the whole nine yards. And Irene had the theory that Hopkins was too inbred, and she created, with President Isaiah Bowman's approval, the Open Scholarship Program, wherein she provided full tuition to 10 students whose only qualification, aside from being able to intellectually get in, was they lived outside of the state of Maryland. I lived outside of the state of Maryland by about a mile in Washington, D.C. And I could no way, I was the first person in my family to go to college, I could no way to go to college without a full scholarship. So I came from a very good high school in Washington, and I had a good college advisor, and he said, hey, how about this? And he discovered this. And so I applied, and then I went over to Hopkins for an interview with Irene, and a few weeks later, she wrote me a letter saying I was in. And I was thrilled. It was the only place I applied to because I couldn't find that many full scholarships. And even a full scholarship meant I had to work for my room and board and, you know, stuff like that. And so that's how I went there, why I went there. And I'll never forget driving my mother's car from Washington to Baltimore and saying to myself, I'm only going to do this once, or I'm going to do it over and over and over again. Please, God, let me do it over and over and over again. And he did. And Irene and I became very, very good friends. I knew her long before she married Dr. Corwin. Absurdly, three of her open scholarships came from Washington, D.C. Hank Bradshaw and myself and another fellow were wise enough, and of course there's only men in those days. And so that's how I went there, okay? Pearl Harbor came along. I was incensed at the Japanese attack. It was exacerbated in my case because my father had been a naval officer in World War I, and he knew all about Pearl Harbor. And I quit college at the end of my third year and enlisted in the Army Air Corps and became a navigator and earned a commission, and I served in Africa and North America and Saipan in the Pacific, flying B-29s. I got out of the Army late because I didn't want to I didn't want to rush home because I had a chance to fly supplies to prisoners of war in Japan. Before we signed the peace treaty, they gave us a list of where our prisoners of war were. Many of them, people that I knew who had flown with. And so I was late. I got back and looked for a job and was excited to have U.S. News and World Report offer me one as a writer. And a few days later, I got a phone call from Stuart McCauley, who was provost of the university then, and who was second only to the president. And I had known him as an undergraduate. And he said, Bill, we got a job here. I wonder if you'd be interested in it. We're going to open a new admissions office with Bill Logan, and we thought you'd like to be his assistant. And I said, what's with the admissions office? He says, well, Princeton has one, and we figure, what the hey, we ought to have one too. And he says, actually, there's stuff on the horizon about the GI Bill, and could be there are going to be a lot of people available, and we'll need one. And I said, gee, Mr. Mack, I am so sorry. I'm in tears, but I said, I made a commitment, and I'm going tomorrow to sign a contract with U.S. News and World Report. And we commiserated with each other and hung up. I went to U.S. News and World Report. Here I'd been all over the world for 4.5 years. And in the small print that my father said you must always read, my first assignment was Fairbanks, Alaska. And I just returned from, 16 months in the Pacific, a year in Africa. And I said, you've got to be kidding. And they had said nothing to me about that as being a cub reporter with U.S. News. And I said, I'm not going to sign it. I went outside. I went into a phone booth on the corner. I called Mr. Mack, and I said, have you filled that job yet? He says, no. I said, don't do a thing. I'll be there in 40 minutes. And I drove to Baltimore as fast as I could, and that's how I went to work there. I worked in the admissions office for a few years.
Hold on now.
Yeah.
Did you have a degree?
Nope.
Did you ever finish at Hopkins?
Sure.
Okay, let's not... jump ahead a few years, tell me.
No, but I was really not enthused about, after 4.5 years of combat, becoming a collegian. I'd been a collegian for 3 years, and it wasn't that all fired great. I enjoyed it and so forth, and I had a lot of fun with the play shop and the extracurricular activities that I did, but I came, and Mac... my relationship with Wilson Schaffer and McCauley and Irene were such that they didn't give a damn about a degree. And they hired me. And Dr. Schaffer was one of my favorite teachers when I was an undergraduate. I had majored in psych. And my mother was climbing the walls because I didn't have my degree. And so I went to Wilth, whose office was right down the hall from right in Homewood House, and he arranged a program for me with courses, one of which he taught me as a tutorial in the White House every Wednesday at noon for a year on abnormal psych, the most fantastic experience of my life. And so somewhere along the line, I graduated. And for my mother's sake, who was dying of cancer, I went through the graduation ceremony. Milton was sick. That's when he was having his back problem. And he was flat on his back in bed in the house, couldn't move. And Carlisle Barton substituted for him. He was the chairman of the board for 30 years. And when I walked up on the stage to get my diploma, he damn near fell off the stage. And he said, what on earth are you doing here? And I said, just shake my hand, Mr. Barton, and give me my diploma for my mother to see. Something came up wherein... the university needed a recognized they needed a development program. They really had to have someone, and no one did that. After the war, they had, in addition to the admissions office, they hired Lynn Poole, who was director of public relations, and who was fantastic. As I'm sure you know, he did the Johns Hopkins Science Review.
Tell me about him.
Lynn Poole was a former flyboy, like myself, from the Army Air Corps, but he was a groundsman, a public relations officer. And he was hired by Mac and Irene and Schaffer to be public relations director, again, anticipating this is going to be a whole new ball game after World War II. And these thousands of applicants. We used to go to lunch in the faculty club every day, the three of us who were in the admissions office, Logan, myself, and a man named Trudeau Thomas, who later became an executive at Hofstra University. And we would come back from lunch, and there would be 25 men standing in line outside of our office. They had the GI Bill. They wanted to go to college. Many of them hadn't finished high school, and we saw each and every one of them, and we counseled them. And 606, I've forgotten it, 606 something Avenue in Chicago, which was the American Medical Association educational program, where they were, you know, they were ready to go to Hopkins Med School, and they hadn't finished high school. And the AMA had a program to help veterans. And we did a lot. It was a great service that not only we, I'm sure other universities were doing the same thing. But then the development program came along, and they, and Lowell Reed came in as president, and he was feeling very strongly about the need for it. So he said to them, "Why don't we find somebody around who can do this for us?" And Mac called me. Luke Hopkins was chairman of the board then, and Luke sat down with me and talked with me and said, "Would you be interested in this?" And I accepted with alacrity because it was because I loved the university, and the admissions thing had sort of waned down, and we were in a much more normal pattern, and so I took the job. And I worked for the university representative for the Johns Hopkins Fund when Doug Coleman was brought in, and that was a brief that lasted a few years, not long. And then the next thing I know, I wound up in the, because the Johns Hopkins Fund office was then down on Mount Vernon Place, and this was, as you know, between serving as a fundraising arm for the university and the hospital, and had a joint board of trustees and that sort of thing. And but then they said, they got serious at Homewood and said, "We want our own development officer, and it's going to be Bill Lachlan." And I went up in the top of the Homewood house, in a little attic up there. And I had a title of something, I don't know, development officer, I think, or something like that.
Hold on. This is the very, very, very beginning of having development officers at...
Yeah, I don't know. There was a Johns Hopkins fund, which wasn't that all-fired successful. The reason being, it is very difficult, and you found this out, to meld the medical and the Homewood. You know, it's oil and water in many instances. And I was first assigned in that area to get out of the admissions office, and I didn't want to leave the admissions office. They wanted me to be their person in that regard. And then Reed said, I'd like Bill here.
Here being Homewood.
Homewood. And Schaffer and McCauley applauded that, apparently. And so they brought me back to Homewood and put me up in the attic.
Okay. As you know, Homewood House is completely changed now. It's a museum. Mm-hmm. Take me into Homewood House as an administration building. Okay. What was it like? Who was there?
Okay.
What did it feel like?
Okay. It was first place, Homewood House was built by Charles Carroll of Carrollton as a wedding present for his son. It is one of the finest examples of Georgian architecture in the world. Milton Eisenhower's house, he is a five-part house, is what they call the Homewood House. It has two wings on the end, and a big thing in the middle, and connectors.
Wait!
Oh God, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Okay.
Talking about Homewood House and what was it like in those days, okay? Mm-hmm. And the answer was, well, it housed the president. It housed the dean, and really, Schaffer was the dean, and there was only one dean of the university. There was a dean of the medical school, but Schaffer was the dean. I mean, he set all the standards academically. So Schaffer was in there. McCauley was in there, the provost. The president was in there. The director of public relations was in there, Lynn Poole. He was down at the end. I was in there. And then when Milton came, he brought Keith Spaulding with him. And so, from Penn State. And so, I was, at that time, I was called assistant to the president. Because that was the euphemism for a development officer in those days.
Okay.
All right, and it was great, particularly when the president was Milton Eisenhower, whose brother just happened to be in the White House at the time, and I had no trouble getting doors open for me, and so Keith Spaulding was there, and Keith was Milton's assistant. And I was the president's assistant. So I sat down with Keith, and I said, and he's I'd never met him, and he was very nice, and I said, what the hell are we going to do about this? And he said, gee, I don't know. He says, I do everything personal. Milton was a widower. So he says, you know, I take his dog to the vet, I get his car greased, and he really put himself down as a lackey type of aide, which was he surely wasn't. He was a brilliant executive and Milton's boss in many, many things. Milton once wrote a check and the bank sent it back because it wasn't his signature. Well, Milton had never signed a check for the last 3 years. And Keith signed Milton's checks, and they knew Keith's signature, but they didn't know Milton's. And in those days, banks really paid attention to, you know, who's putting in checks. So what we decided to do, I said, I'll tell you what, let's take my name out of the catalog for a year. And at the end of the year, let you and Dr. Eisenhower and I sit down and decide what we're going to do with me. And because I really didn't want to leave, and I like Keith so much, and I greatly admired Dr. Milton. Milton Eisenhower is the greatest man I've ever known in my life.
Tell me why.
because he had constant vision. He always was talking about what we're going to do. He never paid any attention to what we did. Good or bad, it's history. It's done. He was the most tomorrow person that I've ever known. And he impacted upon my life more than any other person has, except my bride of 52 years. Milton was never satisfied with the status quo. Also, in addition to being visionary, he was incredibly honest and honorable. Example, we had a cigar box for petty cash in the office, and we had stamps in it. And every time Dr. Milton would write Ike, and he often wrote him, and he had a red telephone on his desk that connected to the phone on Ike's desk. I'd bring my kids in there, and the phone would ring. I said, don't you touch it, because the only person on the other end of that phone was Dwight D. Eisenhower. And it no secretaries, none of that nonsense. It only rang in Milton's office. And so but he would write Ike, and he'd send him things in the mail. And he'd go in and buy a stamp, and then fish in his pocket and take out, 21 cents or whatever postage was in those days. And, we had three secretaries that worked for us. They went out of their mind every month balancing the damn petty cash account and accounting for the stamps that were missing and the money. And maybe I grabbed a stamp and forgot to pay for it or something. But that was Milton. He was immensely honest. The other thing was that he was a tireless perfectionist. What does that mean? That meant that at Johns Hopkins University, when Milton was president and Keith and I were working for him, any time a person phoned him or wrote him, that person got a response the day it came in. For example, an irate alumnus would say that his grandson was getting a raw deal in freshman chemistry, and he wanted to know what the hell the president was going to do about it. And Milton would write back that day and say, I was disappointed. Milton never apologized. He taught me that. He says, don't ever apologize to anybody for anything. I said, what do you mean, don't apologize? How the hell do you handle something? He says, well, you say, I was disappointed to learn that you were dissatisfied with the car I sold you that broke down on the way out of the driveway. But you don't apologize. So Milton would answer immediately, and most of the answers were written by Keith or me. And he'd say, dear Mr. Jones, class of 29, I am so sorry to hear that you are dissatisfied with what has happened to you. I've referred the matter to Dean Schaffer, and if you do not hear from him in 72 hours, call me at this number, which is the direct line that rings on my desk. And then he would carbon in Schaffer. And Schaffer would know damn well that he had better fix whatever it is that needs to be fixed. And the only thing I said to you just now that was wrong was to say, I'm sorry to hear. Milton didn't say, I'm sorry, but Milton had a way of saying everything but that. Well, the reason about this guy being a tireless perfectionist was the secretaries left the office every night at 5 o'clock. And Milton and Keith and I were excellent typists. And there were no electric typewriters. We had royal standards. And we would write every letter. And Milton would call us in at 5 minutes to 5 and say, here's my mail. Darn. Keith, you handle this one. Bill, you handle that one. He looks at it. He says, well, this is from my brother. I'll handle this myself. And so forth. He had 5 brothers or 4 brothers. And we'd go back to our respective offices. We would do the letters. We would, you'll pardon the expression, sign his name, which we could sign better than he could. And we would walk together to the mailbox, which was right there at the end of the walk next to the Homewood House, and put those letters in. And Maria's roast and my children in Riderwood would wait until Dad gets his last letter done that day. And I learned from him, and so I'm the same way. I have a flawless credit record because when I get a bill in the mail, and my mail is delivered in Florida about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a bill from the phone company. And sometimes that's very complex because I have a company, and so I have personal charges and corporate charges. I will stop everything and spend the hour it takes to take that $150 bill and break it out and write 2 checks and put them in the mail. And if our post office pickup is gone, I will drive to the post office and put them in the mail there. And they'll go out usually before midnight. That's why he was so exceptional and so great, and he inspired that from all of us. It wasn't it wasn't just the guys lucky enough to be his assistants, but he inspired that from the university. He loved students, spent a lot of time with them. He lived on the campus, but he was the greatest man that I've ever known. And no one's come close to him, including Ike, whom was a trustee of the university after he retired from the White House. And I used to go to all the board meetings, and I've seen Ike in action, and I've seen Milton in action. And I'm on tape, so I'll be very careful how I phrase this, but one is inordinately more impressive to me than the other. And Ike was a wonderful person, and a wonderful man, and my commander in chief, I guess, when I was in combat. But Milton was the guy that shaped my world, and made me everything that I am today. Springfield College hired me because I was Milton's assistant. Franklin and Marshall College hired Keith because he was Milton's assistant. University of Wisconsin hired Mac Moose because he was Milton's assistant. And the Milton's successor at Kansas State was hired because he had been Milton's assistant. And Milton's successor at Penn State was hired because he had been Milton's assistant. I was told when I left there in 65 that there were 7 of us who were college or university presidents who had been assistants to Milton Eisenhower. When I accepted the job to go to Springfield College, I did it in careful and full and advanced preparation, consultation with Dr. Eisenhower. Because I didn't apply for the job. It came out of the blue. Somebody, the chairman of the board, was impressed that there was a younger guy who was working for Ike's brother. And so I told Milton about it, and he said, "Well, what's his name?" And I said, "Norman Keith," and he was an oil executive in Washington, was chairman of the board at Springfield College. And he said, I need his phone number. And he called him up and he invited him to dinner. And he invited me to dinner, just Norm and myself. And when I got Mr. Keith and I took him into Dr. Eisenhower's house, he stood there in the front door and he said, if I had a gun, I would shoot you right here and right now. And deafening silence. I didn't know what to say. Norm didn't know what to say. And Eisenhower smiled and said, come on in, it's time to have a drink. And when I accepted the job, which I did with his full support, he invited Maria and me to dinner, just the three of us in this table, which was much longer than this room. I sat at one end, Milton at the other end, and Maria sat right next to him. And she received a PhD dissertational course in how to be a first lady and how to run the president's home on a campus, because I lived in a beautiful mansion on the campus at Springfield College. I didn't build it, I inherited it. And that was typical of Milton. He spoke at my inauguration, and he just did everything for me. All the rest of his life, he was concerned about me. I would visit him at least once a year, and he was. I knew Bronk, I knew Reed, I knew Bowman. And I left when Milton was president, so I didn't know any of his successors. The rest of them that I knew didn't hold a candle to him. And in fact, you talk about how great Gilman was. Look here. NATO would not exist without Milton Eisenhower. Because Milton Eisenhower and Macaulay, and I was privileged to be an observer and tag along, bought size. Saiz was in an abandoned girls' school on Florida Avenue in the worst part of Washington, D.C., right near Griffith Stadium. And Milton was in cahoots with Paul Nitze, who still, to this day, is one of the key political figures in the world. My son, who was in international economics, said, you know, Dad, I talked to him at a cocktail party 3 weeks ago in London or somewhere. And Chris Herder, who was a former governor, former Secretary of State, former governor of Massachusetts, they said to Milton, we got to get out of this girls' school. And Milton and I raised $7 million from about six sources, including Ford Foundation, Carnegie, Rockefeller. And we bought, and the Brookings School in the 1700 block of Massachusetts Avenue had been condemned for years and was boarded up. On the day that Ike left the White House, he signed the papers that transferred Brookings School to the Johns Hopkins University.
Brookings School?
Brookings School. Across the street from the Brookings Institute.
Brookings Institute, okay.
But it was Brookings School. Had nothing to do, it's a public school. The Washington, D.C. government owned it.
Uh-huh.
And it was abandoned. I mean, they had moved to another school or something, and it was a mess. It was a plywood windows and that sort of thing, and just sitting there. It was awful. And Ike signed that en route to Mr. Kennedy's inauguration. It was one of the, and he, because he told us this. He said, "Well, I did one thing for you guys. I just want you to know that." And so that became Saïs. That became Saïs in Bologna. That became Grove Haines, who ran that in Bologna. Grove Haines attracted pre-diplomats from all over Europe. Grove Haines put them together as roommates, put a French student with a German student, put an Italian student with a student from the Middle East. And I went on the 10th anniversary of Saïs. Maria and I toured the European capitals. It was the 10th anniversary of Saïs, so it wasn't a very old school. And we were hosted in every capital by a diplomat who was a graduate of Saïs. One young, a staff member in the French embassy, no, a staff member in the Austrian embassy in Paris, was Alois Mach, who became the Chancellor of Austria and just retired a few years ago.
What's his name?
Mach, M-O-C-K, and his first name was A-L-O-I-S. And he was Chancellor of Austria for many years until, I'd say in the last 3 or 4 years. And he and his wife had dinner for us with the other Saïs alumni in the Paris area. And it became a situation that Saïs was so important that if you wanted to be in the diplomatic corps in Europe, you went to Saïs in Bologna. And you were so credentialed. Milton supervised Nitzi's insistence about academic excellence. Saïs was the first school wherein every student was given one of four majors: economics, international relations, and so forth. He had to select one of those. In addition, he had to select a country, part of the world where he was going to do it. He had to specialize in China, specialize in Japan, specialize in Austria, and so forth. And then he had to write his master's thesis about international economics in Austria. Simultaneously, before language labs, he had to learn Austrian. He wrote his thesis in German. Saïs had tons of part-time faculty members who would come to the school and interview this young man having read his thesis and challenge it. And he would discuss it with them in their tongue before he graduated. So that's why it took 2 years to get a master's degree in international relations at Saïs. Now imagine that guy going out to Austria, where he knows the international, the economic situation there, where he speaks the language, he writes them the language. I mean, boy. Those guys then got together in Europe, and after the war, and this is why Herder and Nitzsche did it in the first place, they say, hey, we've got to start you can't tell this Frenchman that all Germans are bad, because he's been his roommate for the last 2 years. And that European impact, and it was equally true in China, it was equally true in Hong Kong, it was equally true in Japan, except we didn't have schools over there. When I went to Springfield College, one of the things that I'm recognized for is that I was in China long before Hopkins and shortly after Mr. Nixon, and working with the Ministry of Finance and Ministry of Education in China, and executing an agreement between his country and my college for training students, interchanging students and faculty. You know why I was there? Because he had learned the game. He was 6'5". He learned the game of basketball from Ma Chi Wei, who was a graduate of Springfield College, and Dr. Ma taught him basketball because he was such a big guy. And when he came, the Minister of Education came to the United States and toured the major universities. One of the places they went to was Harvard. And on the day that his a group of 15 went to Harvard, he came to Springfield College. And the Union News in Springfield had a banner headline that Minister of Education passes up Harvard to come to Springfield College. That's Milton. That's Milton that taught me the importance of international education.
Now, we've got to step back here, okay, because this is one of the things on my list that I need to understand.
Okay.
You've given me just a great explanation of Sais after it existed. But how did that initial affiliation come to be? Because Sais already existed.
Yeah.
So how did it get mixed up with Johns Hopkins?
Okay, well, first place, Sais existed, but it was on the rocks. It was having immense problems. It had no real recognition. I think that the founding director was Phil Thayer, who was the dean when we acquired it. But what you had was, first place, Milton was a great Republican leader. I'm sure you've heard the story about the Republican National Committee looking for a presidential candidate. And they were meeting and so forth, and they were talking about this. Milton, along with David Lawrence, Milton was the number one Republican in Pennsylvania. Milton nominated Barry Goldwater for president of the United States, and he was a powerhouse. So they made the comment, why don't we ask Eisenhower? And they discussed this, a handful of people, and they said to one of their minions, you know, an important minion, go talk to Eisenhower. He got to the door and he paused, and he turned back and he said, Which one? And the guy impatiently responded, the university president, of course. And Ike was president of Columbia University. And he says, oh, okay. And the story was that he went to Ike and Ike agreed to do the job. I had drinks alone one night with Milton, and I just told him this story, and I said, you know, you've heard it many times, I'm sure I've heard it. And I said, Dr. Milton, you know, I really want to know, what's the truth of that? And he looked over and snapped his fingers and said, darn, he says, your drink needs to be filling, Bill. And he reached over and picked it up and walked out of the room and came back with a fresh drink, and that's the last I ever heard of it. But there's no question that he was as luminous in many quarters as his distinguished brother was.
We need to turn the tape over. That's okay. A great way to end this sign.
Okay. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I know that both of them were great university presidents. And I have done a little bit of reading about Ike, and he did a hell of a job at Columbia. A hell of a job at Columbia. In any event, so getting back to your question, how did Sice get into all this? Remember that Milton was in Baltimore because Ike wanted him nearer. Milton was widowed rather recently, and it was a sad, sad thing because Milton told me this more than one time, and he rarely repeated himself. They built a chapel to his wife on the campus, and he says, I passed it going to work every day. And, of course, so many things happen in the chapel. And Milton would never admit this to me, but Ike was in the White House. And Milton was, Penn State is not Philadelphia. It's in the boonies. And so Barton and company, the board, told the president, Dr. Bronk, that he could not be president of Johns Hopkins University and the National Science Foundation simultaneously. And following that board meeting, which I did not attend, Dr. Bronk resigned from the university and became the distinguished president of the National Science Foundation. That created the vacancy that called Lowell Reed out of retirement to make him acting president for a few years. And then they got Dr. Milton to come, but one of the real reasons that he came was to be nearer his brother. Milton was the youngest of the five men, and Ike was the eldest, and they were the closest. I rarely met the other three. One of them was a banker out in the West somewhere, and they were all pretty successful, I gather, but they were, Ike and Milton were so close. So close. Keith and I would have something lined up that is so important. We had Milton set for a party or something, and he's going to be the star, and this is going to be at some club in downtown New York or somewhere. And about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Milton would say to Keith or to me, get the car. And we would call, and he had a chauffeur. And we say in horror, what do you want the car for? And he said, it's so exciting. He says, Duke Wayne just arrived in the White House with his latest film. And Ike has invited me over, and he's going to show it tonight. I'm going over for dinner. And you didn't say, Drew Milton, well, you can't do that. You said, yes, sir. Well, have a nice time, Dr. Milton. When he became more mellow, I marveled that Ross addressed him as Milton. And my esteem for Ross went way up. But he was Dr. Milton to us, and he had, 32 or 33 honorary degrees. But he was, I'm sorry to keep gravitating back, but you ask questions, and within my scope of the 125-year history, which is only 20 years, I have to keep coming back to him. So Ike, remember, Herter had been Secretary of State. NITSE had been the founder of SAIS with Thayer. Milton was an internationalist. I mean, Ike used him all the time. When Nixon went to Russia, Ike didn't dare let him go without somebody to watch him. And Milton was drafted and sent to look after him and keep his nose clean. So they were really, and Ike was a great internationalist. I mean, you know, he had been there as the commanding general. So they all were interested in what happens to diplomacy when this war ends. And before the war ended, SAIS started. And Herter and NITSE and Thayer were the responsible ones. But it wasn't going well when Milton got there. See, Milton came in, when was it? About 52. Ike was elected in 52. Milton must have come about the middle of 52.
To
Hopkins?
No. No, it was 56.
Because
Reed was there for a couple of years.
Okay.
And he arrived in 56, I believe.
All right. Well, but Ike was still in the White House.
Oh, yes.
Ike was getting ready for a second term. Mm-hmm. All right. And so they were all very close, that all being Herter. I mean, I'd see them in and out all the time, and NITSE, and they took seriously, you know, what are we going to do to stabilize the world? I mean, there are so many unsung heroes in history who should be sung heroes. But you don't think of them, you know. You think of Milton as a great university president. In my book, the best that ever lived. But you can't ignore the fact. Yeah, but what about the other things that he did? If you could have heard him, as I stood beside him talking to the president of the Ford Foundation about this is the last chance for this country to do things right, and we simply don't have the person power with the proper training to pull it off. And that was exactly Milton's conviction, and he was right. I mean, we've had 50 years of peace in Europe, except for Kosovo and little things like that, but basically, and I submit that integral to that have been the cadre of leaders that came out of the School of Advanced International Studies of the Johns Hopkins University. And you will find them in every corner of the world. There's a book written about it, about SAIS. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine had a son who said he was going to SAIS, and he said, Bill, do you know anything about this SAIS or something? And I said, you mean SAIS? He said, yeah. And so I said, and he's a wonderful friend, and I wanted to help him. So I picked up the phone and I called public relations over at Homewood, and I said, do you have anything about... No, I called Washington. I said, do you have anything about the history of SAIS or something, and give me some background about it? And they sent me a number of nice things, a very nice lady, but including this book, which I read, and I was astounded, because I thought I was the only one who really knew how pivotal that institution had become, and how just a handful of people made it happen. And they were running against ominous competitors, Georgetown University, American University, and so forth. And they said, yeah, but we are going to do something that those places don't do. And they did.
Why did they affiliate with Johns Hopkins?
Well, why did Zeiss come with Hopkins?
Mm-hmm. Well, and why did Hopkins? Well, you pretty much told me why Hopkins wanted Zeiss.
Right.
But why did Zeiss go with Hopkins?
Well, look here. If when they went with Hopkins, they're going with a president who has an international reputation, who has been the spokesperson for the President of the United States. Milton Eisenhower graduated from Kansas State University, and he had a job as a drama critic and opera critic for the Kansas City Star or something, cub reporter. And a person who had been affiliated with that newspaper became ambassador to Scotland. And he liked Milton. And at the age of, I think it was 26, Milton was stationed in Scotland with the State Department in this capacity. You read it in his biography. And so he began as an internationalist, and he always, when he was at Kansas State, when he was at Penn State, he was always being called upon by the president, including Kennedy, to do things on an international scene. And therefore, it's quite reasonable for him to be attracted to be searching around for Zeiss. I don't know whether, I didn't find Zeiss for him. Maybe Keith did, maybe Milton did, maybe Chris Herder. I'm sure that Chris must have had many contacts. As Secretary of State, he had many contacts with Milton. He would send Milton on errands around the world. It was, to me, very logical that they would come together. And it was a great alliance.
Before Zeiss,
okay,
became part of Hopkins, mm-hmm, there was an international school, the Walter Hines Page School.
School, yeah.
And Owen Lattimore was the head of that.
Right.
I am very unclear about what happened to the Page School, and I know somewhat about the Lattimore story. You were a witness to all that.
Yeah.
What happened there?
I have to be very careful because I was a witness to it, but I wasn't that close to it. The person who was the closest to the Lattimore situation was Macaulay. And of course, it was very embarrassing to have a member of our faculty called the chief communist agent in the United States. And unfortunately, many, many, many people believed that accusation. I have no idea whether it was true or not. I knew Dr. Lattimore. And frankly, if I wanted any spying done, he'd be the last person I'd hire. Because I knew him, he was on the campus, I had lunch with him at the faculty table all the time. In my opinion, he was a lightweight. And I can't imagine the Communist Party picking him to be their boy. Some of the critics said, well, he just pretended to be dumb. Oh. Wasn't smart. He really wasn't smart. I mean, he was an absent-minded professor. He's sort of a nice guy. He's an absent-minded professor, And he was hired, but the Walter Hines Page School was really a lightweight before Seitz. It was not an integral, it was totally delimited to Homewood. I'm unaware that they had any activity in Washington.
No, I don't think so.
And it was, I don't know whose idea, it was always there. When I came there in 38, it was there.
Right.
And I don't know whose idea it had been or what its function had been. My impression was that it was pretty much a totally graduate effort where the students were tolerated to do work and help the people, the faculty who were running it. But it never was strong. But when Milton got the funds to build this gorgeous building, which I'm going to see on this trip, I'm going to be here for after Christmas, and I'm going to call up Seitz and get over there and see it. That gave us, it's a show place, and that gave us a presence in Washington that was really substantial. And having the brother of the president of the university in the White House didn't hurt us any either. And so that's how they got together. And the Page School, I think that the Page School went when Lattimore went, and as you know, he resigned. But it was great embarrassment to Mac, to P. Stuart McCauley. And
you've talked about Stuart McCauley, mm-hmm. mentioned him a number of times.
Right.
Tell me about him. I know so few people who actually knew him. Please tell me about him.
He was a native of Nova Scotia, because Maria and I weren't going to take a vacation up there once, and we sat down with Mac and his wife, and we had dinner at their house, and he was telling us how to drive it, and we said, well, we figured we'd go run up there for a day, and he says, you don't run up to Nova Scotia for a day, and so forth. He was... I really don't know... Mame, whether he was an alumnus of the university or not, that would be in the record. I just know that when I came there, the president was, when I came as a student, Isaiah Bowman was president. And Isaiah Bowman had him as provost. And that was the equivalent of an executive vice president. Everything had to go through Mac. In other words, if Schaffer has a new scheme academically, he clears it with Mac. He was very, very strong and very, very important, and he loved the university, and he many years he was. The presidents came and went, but Mac was there. And he brought a great deal of stability to him. Ross knew him very well. Ross knew him better than I, because Ross, I remember Ross telling me that he was over in the hospital one day on business, and Mac was dying in the hospital. And he went to the nurse at his room and said in a low voice, how's Mr. McCauley doing? And this booming voice from the room emerged saying, Ross, is that you? Get in here. And he said, he went in, and Ross told me, he says, Bill, he says, I spent the most wonderful hour of my life talking to him, and a day or two later, he had died. Those days, one of the things that has changed in education so dramatically in my years of association, which go back now, 60 years? One of the things that's changed so dramatically was the proliferation of administration. It's awesome. At lunch in the faculty club, we had a long table, and there were, I'd say, 20 persons could sit at it. People like Bill McElroy, who was chairman of the biology department and subsequent president of the National Science Foundation, or director, or whatever his title was. Rob Roy, who was head of the School of Engineering. But one woman, only one, Irene Davis. And Irene and Wilson Schaffer and Mac would fashion the institution. You know, they were it. And later, Bill Logan was in on it, the admissions director. But they were it. They ran the place. And the president, they worked for the president. The president was powerful, but he also often would say, and in my presence more than once, you know, Irene, whatever you think best, do it. I got to know Dr. Bowman because he was president when Mac hired me. And so I was diddling around with the admissions office and having the time of my life. And Dr. Bowman called me in one day, and I had known him slightly as an undergraduate. I was sort of a student leader. And he called me in one day, and he said, I really shouldn't tell you this story, but I'm going to, because I've told it to very few people. He called me in, and he said, it was after the war. War was over, and there was something called the WPB, the War Production Board. And you couldn't do anything without clearance with them, because the War Production Board was seeing to it that those of us who were fighting had, you know, guns and ammunition and stuff. We wanted to build an addition to the gymnasium, and the WPB, which said only laboratories can be built. No theaters, no gymnasia, no parking lots, and so on, because the critically short materials that existed in 1945 had to go to hospitals for veterans and things of this sort. So Dr. Bowman called me in, and he said, here are the blueprints. And he had the architect there, a wonderful guy, I forget his name for the moment, and he said, here are the blueprints for us. And he says, we've got to expand with all these GIs coming in, and we've got to have something for them to do, and our gymnasium would fit in this room in those days. So he said, he said, what I want you to do is go to Washington and get these things cleared by the WPB. And so he's sending this kid. I was in my 20s. But what the hell? And he said he didn't have anything to lose. And he said, if you do that, I'll give you, I'll increase your salary by $250 a month for the next 3 months. And I said, great. You know, hell, I don't know whether I was married then, but I was about to be or something. So I jumped at it. I drove over to Washington, went to the WPB, started going up and down the corridors. I learned in working Washington that you don't spend much time in the corridors. You go to the snack bar, you go to the restaurant, and you listen and you eavesdrop and you find out who's more important than whom. And so I found a guy, and I said, by the way, speaking of Johns Hopkins, I happen to work there. Of course, I'd brought up Johns Hopkins initially. I've got a problem. I wonder if you could help me with it. And he said, well, I'll have 10 minutes. Come on up to my office. And it went up. And he, I told him the problem, and I said, we got these GIs, we got to do something. He says, gee, I would like to help you, but he says, we can't touch it unless it's a laboratory. Can't touch it. So I said, okay, and I thanked him profusely, and I left, and I went, raced back to Baltimore. I got a hold of Dr. Bowman, I got a hold of the architect. We all met in his office immediately. And I said to the architect, I want you to take these blueprints and take them back to your office. And don't change a thing on them except the name. And you don't call gymnasium annex at Johns Hopkins University. You call it kinesiological laboratory at Johns Hopkins University. And he said, okay. And Bowman smiled. Next morning, I had him. I'm back in Washington. I go back in the same office. I said, I listen to what you say. We've scrapped the idea of the gym. But here, let me show you these. And he said, oh, kinesiological laboratory. Oh, and he starts stabbing up, proof, proof, proof. And we went back. I took him back, and we built it. And I went to Dr. Bowman, and I said, sir, I've gotten two payments for my $250, and I really in good conscience can't accept the third, so please tell Mr. Baker, the treasurer, not to add $250 to my paycheck next month, because the job's done. It didn't take me 3 months. And I don't know what on earth triggered me to tell you that, but
it's a great story.
It's a true story, and it was reflective of the times you were talking to Russ Baker and not knowing the wartime. The war. I didn't know the wartime because I was fighting the war.
But you know what you do know? You know what it felt like on that campus the day of Pearl Harbor. Tell me about that.
In the first place, anybody alive knows where he or she was on Pearl Harbor. Anyone living, lucky enough to be living. I was at the Redskins football game in Washington with my mother because she loved the Redskins. She didn't know anything about any sports. She loved the Redskins because George Preston Marshall, who owned the Redskins, married Corinne Griffith, a silent movie star, and Corinne Griffith introduced halftime ceremonies to professional football, and the Griffith Stadium was sold out, and my mother had two tickets, and I would go, and all during the game, we kept getting interrupted with announcements. Would General so and so call such and such a number. And I'd never heard that before. You know, it's second down and 10 yards to go, and this voice comes in, and then Admiral so-and-so and Colonel so-and-so. And I said to my mother, I said, something's going on here. And as soon as we got out, I heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor. And, you know, there's a six-hour time difference and so forth. And I went back to Baltimore from the game, and I was so upset, and the campus was all upset. I mean, I lived in the dorm, and all the guys in the dorm were all upset, and we were worrying, you know, what are we going to do, and so on and so forth. And people were really frightened. And some of us were infuriated, and I just said, you know, it's going to be awfully difficult for me to settle down and be a student after this. And so I went down and enlisted. My mother was horrified, and I enlisted, and I couldn't go because they didn't have any place for me. I got a job in a butcher shop, I guess, just to keep a little money coming in. And It was awful, but I know that the only thing in my lifetime that it had has had the impact of Pearl Harbor was the Kennedy assassination. It's the only thing that, I mean, of all the other. In Hopkins, a fascinating impact in the scientific community was Sputnik. And I'm here to tell you that the talk around the faculty table after that thing went off among the physicists and among the aeronautical engineers and the astrophysicists and APL, we were involved in that. We were moving to Columbia, Maryland, from Silver Spring. And Milton was also a big part of that, as was Macaulay. That was, we Americans were really frightened by this. It was so beyond the realm of possibility. Lynn Poole, I told you, had the Johns Hopkins Science Review. Of course, television in those days was all live. And he would have his guests, and he would have them for dinner. And he would invite colleagues from the university to join them for dinner, usually if there was some tie-in with what the guest was about. And we were invited to dinner. Maria and I were invited to dinner by Lynn and his wife with von Braun. And Werner von Braun was a bright, nice young fellow. He was a little bit older than I was, but not that much. And he had done the V-2 rockets that damn near destroyed Britain. And somehow we kidnapped him and had him working for us. And he's talking about, his Lynn's guess, what's going to happen in space. And I'm not a scientist at all. And I said, Dr. von Braun, how do you know that when you put those things up there, they're going to orbit? I can't comprehend that. And he gave me a short course in saying gravity. You get away from gravity, and there are other gravitational pulls around the universe. And I said, yeah, but you don't know that. You've never been there. He says, they're there. Trust me, they're there. And he said that same thing that night. And we've told our children and our grandchildren how lucky we were to have had a brush with this man. But again, Lynn Poole's contribution was he recognized television before anybody else did. And he had the Johns Hopkins Science Review on PBS for 13 years or something. In the Hopkins Library, there will be copies of all of his books, and some of them were even the intricacies of television production, how to write for television and direct and so forth. But that brought, people knew Johns Hopkins then because of the Science Review, because it was all over the country. And it was, a great thing. One last thing, and I've got to stop this. I know I'm taking too much of your time, but you ask for something. I just wrote a letter a few weeks ago to the president of the Ford Foundation. I don't know her. I know who she is. In my line of work, you know those things. And I wrote her a letter, and I reminded her, I said, there's something you might be interested in your history. I said that in about 1961 or two, the Ford Foundation made a matching challenge grant to 5 universities, Cornell, Johns Hopkins, Vanderbilt, Stanford, and I don't know what the other one was. And what the Ford Foundation said was, we will give you $12 million if you will raise $6 million in new monies in the next 3 years. They chose the five universities because they felt that they were greatly under-realizing their capacity to attract gift support. And so Milton and I were summoned to New York and met with the president of the Ford Foundation. And he told us what we had to do. And we came back, and $6 million. I would imagine that at that time that the total gift income of the university would be in the neighborhood of less than $1 million. I mean, the alumni fund was a little Mickey Mouse thing that Steinwald was running, but no one paid that much attention to it. And so what happened was we raised $6 million in less than a year, including Mrs. White for the Newton H. White Athletic Center. She was my prospect, and she was $2 million of the six right there. So we got our $12 million before the year was out, and I flew back to New York. I hustled, took the congressional back to New York, and got to see the vice president of Ford Foundation. I didn't get to see the president without Milton. And I said, sir, we got a tremendous problem here. We have matched your gift requirement, and we're looking forward to the monies because we need them. But I said, look, here's the literature we've published. We haven't even had a chance to use it yet. And Dr. Eisenhower is going to ask your boss for another $6 million. And he said, that might be arranged. Dr. Eisenhower and I did all the soliciting ourselves, just big prospects. Before 3 years were out, we had raised the second batch of money and qualified for the second. Yes, I went back to the vice president for the third time, and he said, I am so proud of you guys. Won't you come with me? I said, sure. I sure you're going to rush me right into the president's office. He walked me right down to the hall and pushed the down button on the elevator. And he said, no offense, I don't want to see you again. That was Milton's greatness. Milton would, he could go out and he could persuade anybody that this is something distinctive. This is something unique. I use the phrase when I'm talking of how clients should approach gift prospects to say to them, you have to persuade them that your institution is a sound philanthropic investment. It's an expression I use over and over again. It's an expression I first heard Milton use. I stole it from him. Keith and I did a party for Milton at the Waldorf, and we were the MCs, the joint MCs. And it was the days of Huntley and Brinkley on radio and television, and it was Keith and Bill. And we did it back and forth. The one thing that we did, though, that I'll never forget was that we both said in unison, and we'd rehearsed this carefully, every time we did well as a college president, it was because of what Milton Eisenhower had taught us. And we were both reigning college presidents then. And we said, every time we erred, it was because we forgot what Dr. Milton taught us. And that's it in a nutshell.
I understand we need to wind up, but there are two more things I got to have from you. You have mentioned Irene Davis many times. Nobody else has talked about her, and I need to know about this woman. Tell me about Irene Davis.
All right, Irene Davis Corwin. She married Alsop Corwin late in life.
What's his name?
Alsop, A-L-S-O-P-H. C-O-R-W-I-N, professor, full professor of chemistry at Johns Hopkins University. Very distinguished scientist and researcher. It was amusing. She married him, and so she began signing her letters, Irene D. Corwin. And somebody who was dealing with her picked up the phone and said, I don't want to talk to this Corwin woman. I've been dealing with Irene Davis for years, and I damn well want to talk to her. Irene Davis Corwin was a lady who didn't get married until maybe she was 45 or 50 years old. She had a very happy life. She died in her 90s. I used to go see her every single year. My children, knew her. She was the registrar. That was her title. But as I said, she was it in terms of admissions. The only people who mattered at Johns Hopkins University in 1938, in my judgment, were the president, Irene Davis, the registrar, Wilson Schaffer, the dean, Stuart Macaulay, the provost, and Henry Baker, an ex-engineer who was the treasurer. And they were it. There were no committees. This is the thing that fascinated me. I never went to a committee meeting. We went to lunch. And we sat down and we decided, how are we going to skin this cat? And that's what I talk about, the proliferation of administration. Because now, anywhere that I go, including places where I've worked before, there's not a person who is the treasurer. There are 18 persons in the treasurer's office, each of whom is some kind of a vice president. And so that's why Irene Davis is so important, because at that stage of the university, before the war and before the influx of the GI Bill, which meant so much to Johns Hopkins, she set the tone. She was the director of public relations. She designed the Open Scholarship Program to get kids from outside of the state of Maryland, because she said, we're too darned inbred. And my trick in the admissions office, which I learned from Irene, was we had Hopkins wasn't as popular as Harvard, heaven forbid. And after the war, I went to all these fancy prep schools like Choke and Andover, and I said, I got a deal for you. You are anxious to get your kids in a good university, and you're paid a ton of money to get them there. I will guarantee you admissions at Johns Hopkins that we select up to 3 students the first year. If you guarantee me that for every student we select, you send me 2 more, just as applicants. And they're not going to come because you send them. We have to attract them. And we were able to capitalize, and this was not my genius. It was Bill Logan and Irene Davis. And so we were able to capitalize on the GI influx by greatly expanding our sphere of influence among the most noted prep schools in America.
Need to switch tapes.
All right. Okay.
It's Mae Warren. This is tape two with Bill Lachlan on the 23rd of December, 1999 in Herndon, Virginia.
Okay. So that really is, it was the essence of Irene Davis. She was committed to the institution. She understood it thoroughly and fully. And she always, as did all of those leaders, worried about it and worried about making it more national, more international, because it was, first place, the university was, in those days, overshadowed by the medical school and by the hospital. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times when I said as a collegian, I'm going to Johns Hopkins, say, oh, you're going to be a doctor, you know. And so these people at Homewood really worried about this, and the president especially, because he was Homewood. You know, I mean, the dean of the School of Medicine worked for Milton. It wasn't the other way around. And Milton wasn't there more than a week before that became glaringly apparent. And so that, but Davis was pivotal of the founders of what the university became between the 30s and when I left it.
I just want to know who she was. You know, you have all these men in this all-male school.
Yeah, I know it.
What was she like as a human being?
Well,
she must have been tough as nails. Was she?
No, she was charming. Okay, she was physically, she was constantly fighting her weight and complaining about it. And if she were 10 pounds overweight, she would get mad at the waitress in the faculty club who would have the temerity to tell her that they had cream of mushroom soup for lunch. She says, you know I don't eat cream soups. She was an advisor to all the scholarship students. I mean, we went to see Miss Davis if we have a problem, or we have a class conflict or something like that, we better talk to her first. And they said, well, you better see Dean Schaffer, but you better let me talk to him first. And that they would talk at lunch. And then you got into Dean Schaffer, and suddenly everything was working out. She was a maiden lady until she married Alsop. He was married for the first time. There wasn't a lot of marriages going on in those days. I mean, you get married once in those days, and we were all very excited for her, and we liked Dr. Corwin. He was a neat guy, and had a wonderful sense of humor, and a great teacher, and so we thought that was a wonderful alliance, and it lasted for many, many years. In fact, I think Dr. Corwin is still alive.
Oh. Now, you keep alluding.
He would be, not too long ago, I stopped sending him Christmas cards, but you ought to look into, see if Alsop D. Corwin, check the alumni office. Alsop D. Corwin, I wouldn't be at all surprised that he's still living in a house in the Homewood area.
I'll look him up.
Bill Lachlan says you're acquainted with Irene Davis, and I thought I'd talk to you, because if he's alive, he's smart. Alsop D. Corwin, and he lived near the campus in a little house there. Irene they had no children. She had siblings, and she was constantly talking about her nephews and nieces.
Now, you keep alluding to that she was in the faculty club dining room.
Yes.
I thought it was men only.
No.
The faculty club dining room.
No. There were at least two dining rooms in the faculty club. And there was a dining room where women could go and women could host at noon only. At night, all of us would take our wives and children to the faculty club. In the daytime, the men were in the center section. It's another five-part house, and the big center section was us. Irene was out on the side now, but often I would have lunch with Irene or some other man. I couldn't bring her at lunchtime into the main thing.
Okay.
I could go into her side, into the ladies' side of the dining room.
I just wanted to clarify that and see whether it changed, because that's
I don't think, but I do know that I didn't know but one powerful woman in the Johns Hopkins leadership. I mean, all the rest of them worked for somebody. They were, in fact, most of the most powerful people on campus were the secretaries.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I soon learned that if I wanted something, let's say that I wanted something from Bill McElroy, I would go to his secretary and say, I want to talk to Dr. McElroy about such and such. How would you suggest I go about it or something? And she said, well, for one thing, don't you dare mention so-and-so whom you just mentioned, because he can't stand him. Another thing is, he's going to be straight out until he finishes this experiment with his lightning bugs. So don't go near him until the lightning bug season is over. And that's why the secretaries were so powerful. Irene had a secretary who was a very a wonderful lady. But she was an anomaly. There's no two ways about it. It was a men's university. It always had been a men's university, even though the medical school was coeducational from its founding. And Johns Hopkins thought of that.
Before we go, you have got to tell me the story that you started to tell me on the telephone and I cut you off.
Okay.
You were there the night the terrapin was stolen.
Yeah. Okay.
I want to hear from start to finish that story.
Right. Well, first place, when I was hired, when Mac hired me after the war, he said I was to be assistant director of admissions, and I was to be social and athletic director of the dormitory. The dormitory, Alumni Memorial Hall, housed 300 students, 300 men. And I'll tell you two stories about them. The terrapin story. One of the strangest things about Johns Hopkins in those days was that without having a single athletic scholarship, the finest lacrosse players in the world seemed to be attracted to come to Hopkins. They not only were talented, but they were good intellectually, because you couldn't get in Hopkins if you weren't smart. You really had to be. I often feel I wasn't as smart as most people at Hopkins. I got in because Irene was trying to get somebody outside the state of Maryland. But smart people who were great lacrosse players came to Hopkins. The other place they went was to Maryland. And year after year, I mean, the Naval Academy had teams, West Point had teams, some little place, Haverford College had a team, but when push came to shove, it was either Hopkins or Maryland that were national champions year in and year out. So there's an intense rivalry. The symbol of the University of Maryland at College Park is the Terrapin, and they call themselves the Terrapins. So a group of guys in the dorm on the eve of the Maryland Homewood game, which was to be played at Homewood, got into a parade of cars and drove over to College Park after midnight. And they had some engineers in the group. And the Terrapin is almost the size of that sofa. It has to be 4 feet in diameter. And it sat up on a brick pedestal right at the entrance of the university. And it's bolted. So, they had all kinds of...